This is day five of this July 2013 seven-day session. We'll return to the teachings of 20th century Chan Master Xu Yun. He was talking, when we left off yesterday, he was talking about working on a koan. Keep your mind on your koan whenever you are doing anything that does not require your undivided attention. Naturally, if you're flying an airplane, you don't want to start thinking about your koan. I don't know. We do have a veteran airline pilot among our members, a retired airline pilot. I'm going to ask him about this. I've heard that most of the flying of these jets is automatic. Discovering whether or not a dog has Buddha nature will not be much of use to you if you crash your plane. Driving an automobile is also something that requires your full attention. You may not risk killing other people's small selves just because you are trying to dispatch your own. But seriously, people ask us sometimes about driving and working on one's koan as a mu. I would say don't try it in city driving, but you could do it. I've done it for stretches of out on the expressway. But there are many times during a day in which you can safely work on your koan. Well, let me just pause and enumerate some of those. Anytime you're doing something that doesn't require discrimination, that is, anytime you're doing something that is you can do on automatic pilot, there's no word automatic pilot. You can any ordinary brushing your teeth, using the bathroom, of course, walking down the hall, eating. Mowing the lawn, shoveling snow, there's so many things. Sewing that you can do to where you can use the koan. He continues, usually we try to stuff these times with frivolous activity. We play silly games or do puzzles, or listen to the radio, or gossip, or go to some sporting event. These are the times that we should rivet our minds to our koan. No one can ever tell when the magical moment will arrive. And then he gives an example. In China, we call a cut of meat pure meat. It's not mixed up with other ingredients, as, for example, sausage is. Sometimes pure meat means the best cut of meat. People always tell the butcher that's what they want, pure or prime meat. There was once a man who was considering his koan. Every day he had to pass a butcher shop on his way to work. He always heard people clamoring for pure meat, but he never paid them much attention. One day, a woman was buying meat, and according to custom, she insisted that the butcher give her only pure meat. That was what she cried out, "Give me only pure meat." Her insistence particularly irritated the butcher, and he shouted, "Which piece is not pure?" When the man heard this angry shout, he suddenly realized that all the meat is pure meat. That is to say, that everyone contains the pure Buddha nature. Who has Buddha nature? Ha! Who doesn't have Buddha nature? The man attained awakening in that very instant. He got so excited he hopped up and down, jumping around, and kept saying, "Which piece is not pure?" "Aha! Which piece is not pure?" over and over again. In another a text by another Chinese master, he compares our true nature to sandalwood. If you cut up sandalwood, a piece of sandalwood into pieces, every single piece has the same fragrance. This craziness we call Chan disease. Getting ecstatic. It doesn't last very long, maybe only a few days before the victim calms down. But it is a wonderful disease to catch. Fortunately, there is no medicine to cure it. I once heard a story that about a man who had diligently practiced Zen for 30 years, and finally in despair he gave up and just gave himself over to his baser passions and sought out a prostitute. And on his way up the stairs of this brothel, he came to awakening. It's not that hard to believe something like that, because here's the irony, is that sometimes when we give up our grasping, when we give up, then there's a release, and we're able to drop this grasping mind, and that opens the gate to awakening. There are more people who break through their koan on the last day of Sesshin than any other time. That's undoubtedly, it's partly because with each successive day of Sesshin, we are more concentrated. But I think it's also this other thing that could be operating, that on the last day, there are people who give up. I'm using that word in a very special way. They don't. I'm not talking about resigning themselves to. They're not just defeated, but they're giving up the grasping mind. They're letting go of awakening as a goal, and they're just getting thoroughly into the koan, single-mindedly. Finally, when they give up the goal, they can surrender as they never have before to the koan for its own sake, not in order to get something. And that's when they can find this profound intimacy, this absolute intimacy in which the koan reveals itself. That it may take that kind of surrender, may take waiting until the last day and sort of letting go like that in order to reach that state. Doesn't have to. Plenty of people have done this before the last day. But I get the principle of how this could have happened. And then Shu Yun tells another story. A monk once asked Master Zhao Zhou, "What happens after a person finally grasps the non-sensory state?" Zhao Zhou replied, "He lays it down." The monk didn't understand. So this question became his new koan. How can one lay down the absence of something? He worked on this and worked on this, and still he could not understand. So he returned to Master Zhao Zhou and asked, "How can one lay down the absence of something?" Zhao Zhou answered simply, "What you can't lay down, carry away." And instantly the monk was enlightened. And then Shu Yun explains, "You see, Master Zhao Zhou knew that the only thing we can't lay down is our true self. This and this alone is all that we can truly carry with us. Sometimes you hear the expression, you can't take it with you. Usually people mean that you must leave money or fame or power behind when you go to your grave. The ego, too, cannot be taken with you when you enter nirvana. Zhao Zhou was also telling the monk that the attainment of enlightenment is nothing a person can brag about. Nobody can say, I am enlightened, because the experience of enlightenment is precisely an egoless experience. The ego is extinguished, and the pure Buddha self is experienced. There is no I there who can claim to be enlightened. This thing about the monk who goes to Zhao Zhou or Joshu and asks about when a person finally grasps the non-sensory state. The version that appears in most translations of that, it's a koan in the book of koans called the Shoryo Roku, the book of serenity. The version you usually hear is, how about when I have nothing in my mind? To which Zhao Zhou says, lay it down. And he says, but if I have nothing there, how can I lay it down? To which Zhao Zhou says, all right then, carry it out. Carry it away. Xu Yun here offers a couple of explanations for it, but of course the student in Doksan, when presenting this koan, can't rely on explanations. They have to demonstrate it. Yasutani Roshi said, one has to get rid of all concepts until nothing remains. Then one has to rid himself of the idea that there is nothing. It's like doing cleaning with a bucket of water. After you've made everything spotless, you need to dispose of the dirty water that remains. Xu Yun continues, sometimes the teaching of Zen can be as frustrating as the learning of it. And then he tells a story. There once was a Zen master who undertook the instruction of three novices. He explained to them the need for spiritual discipline and ordered that starting from that very moment, they observe the rule of absolute silence. Then, holding his finger to his lips, he ordered them to go to their rooms. The first novice said, oh, Master, please let me tell you how grateful I am to receive your instruction. Whereupon the second one said, you fool, don't you realize that by saying that you broke the rule of silence? And the third novice threw his hands up and said, Lord, am I the only person around here who can follow orders? Sometimes we look around and suppose that nobody else measures up to our standards. We are like those three novices. Often, like that first novice, we say we want to learn, but then we don't really pay attention to what our books or teachers tell us. Or, like the second novice, we understand the rules, but think that they apply only to others. Or, like the third novice, we clamor for praise every time we do what we're supposed to do. Let's look at these three cases. The first novice who says he wants to learn, but then, or train, but then doesn't really pay attention to what he or she is told. A teacher learns pretty early on that at least half of what he's saying to a student, even in doksa, at least half is the student is not taking it in. In order to fully take in what the teacher is saying, the mind, the recipient, the listener, has to be have an empty mind to fully receive it. And too often the mind is clogged with all kinds of things the student isn't even aware of. And so it's like a sunlight that has to find its way through a series of moving panels. Everything has to be lined up perfectly for the student to really hear what the teacher is saying. He may think he does, but it's not really reaching the student. The percentage of stuff that gets through to the student increases in sesshin as the days pass, and the student's mind is more empty. If that's true in Doksan, it's way more so in a Zendo talk. In a Zendo talk, each person doesn't feel the same responsibility for listening as they do when they're alone in Doksan. And so the teacher also has to make peace with the fact that more than half of what is being said in a talk in the Zendo is not reaching people. So why keep doing this? Why keep giving these teachings and instructions and guidance and all? Because some of it gets through. If not at the time, then in the future. This is what Shuyun means when he leads off this chapter by saying sometimes the teaching of Chan can be as frustrating as the learning of it. There's a Buddhist proverb: it's easier to save the beasts than to save mankind. It's also kind of the idea behind beginner's mind. Beginners don't imagine that they've heard it all before. They don't tune out something that they have heard before. And sometimes they can hear what's being said more. More senior people sometimes have a tendency to just check out when they're hearing the teacher starting down a way of teaching that they've heard before. It's easier to save the beasts than to save mankind. Reminds me of a story of the question: what's the difference between a horse and a man? A horse, when it's leaving the barn and bangs its head on the beam, won't do it again. Or the second novice here: we understand the rules but think they apply only to others. We see this in sesshin all the time. And the third one: clamoring for praise every time we do what we're supposed to do. Yeah, that's not as common. You figure out pretty early on in Zen that you're not going to be stroked and praised all the time. Again, Xu Yun says, sometimes we share the frustration of that Chan master. Perhaps we see inattention, laziness, frivolity, or intellectual smugness. Worse, we may see people who are accomplished hypocrites, people who pretend that their interests are purely spiritual, while in fact they are a 99% amalgam of pride, greed, and lust. And then we throw up our hands in dismay and conclude that the golden age of Zen is over. We're too late. There's no hope for Zen. We came just in time for the funeral. Every age thinks it has just missed being included in the golden age of enlightenment. I've spoken to this in teishos in the past, how you read about these masters who lived in the golden age of Zen, the Tang Dynasty, who decried the state of monks, their questionable aspiration. And then he says, Master Yongjie, who studied under the sixth patriarch Wei Nong, worried about the future of Chan. He despaired of the profusion of worldly men and the scarcity of sincere followers of the Buddha Dharma. Alas, he cried in his Song of Enlightenment. This is a famous text that sometimes is used at some monasteries as a chant. Alas, he cried in his Song of Enlightenment, in this time of decadence and worldly corruption, no one cares to submit to discipline. The golden age is over and the era of perversion has begun. And then Xu Yun says, now, this master Yongjie, for all his worries about being in an era of darkness, managed to attain enlightenment in a very short time. He was what you'd call an overnight sensation. In fact, that's how Wei Nong referred to him, the overnight enlightened one. Master Yongjie's lamp burned for a long time in what was supposed to be a dark era. Master Wei Shan, who was born in 771 and died in 863, saw his earthly life end just as the Tang Dynasty's golden age of Chan was ending. Master Wei Shan used to lament, isn't it regrettable that we were born at the end of the Enlightenment period? He despaired of the profusion of worldly men and the scarcity of sincere followers of the Buddha Dharma. How he wished that he had been born earlier. He truly feared that there would be no one to take his place. When I was young, most of the monasteries in the area south of the Three Rivers were destroyed during various rebellions. Many monks of the Zhongnan Mountains came south on foot to help rebuild these monasteries. What did they have? Nothing. They carried a gourd and a little basket and the clothes on their backs. That was all. Everybody wondered what on earth they could possibly accomplish. But they did the job. They rebuilt the monasteries. Later, as these monasteries flourished and more monks were needed, new monks began to arrive. They came in carts, needing yokes and poles to carry all their possessions. And everybody thought, oh, they are too worldly. They won't get anything done. But they did, didn't they? And now when I travel someplace and I see monks getting on trains and airplanes with their matched sets of leather luggage, I find myself saying, oh, they are too worldly. They won't accomplish anything. But they will, won't they? And then he says, you will, won't you? This is there's a wonderful quality of detachment that comes through in Shuyun's writings that we've been reading from, where he can look back and, you know, a lot of old teachers would say, people aren't the way they used to, rah, rah, rah. And he acknowledges that he used to say that, but now he acknowledges that he was wrong. Things were getting done. Things weren't so bad. It's really the wonderful sense of freedom from notions that comes through in these teachings of his. As far as the match sets of leather luggage, in defense of these monks, they were probably given these as by devout lay people who wanted the merit, and so they gave him all this luggage, and the monks wanted to use it. Just a little bit more about the difficulties of getting through to students. This, as we see, is not a new problem. It's a great privilege, a great, great privilege, to be able to expound the Dharma. And the teacher himself benefits from it. There's nothing quite like having to put into words your understanding in order to really get it yourself. That old saying, if you want to master something, teach it. And next he addresses stages of development and difficulties. What stages do we pass through as we progress toward enlightenment? First, as we meditate, we may experience a moment of utter purity and lightness. We may even feel that our body is beginning to levitate, or that our mind is rising up right out of our body so that we can look down and see ourselves sitting below. These experiences are very strange to learn about and stranger still to experience. What is strangest of all is that so many people experience them. So this is among Makyo, this is a less common Makyo, although it does occur. But in Zen, we just consider it just a side effect of doing serious zazen. Nothing to get excited about. It's just an illusory experience, like all makyo. Second, we may experience a state of egoless purity in which we merely witness the objects and events of our environment without being in any way affected by them. Sensory data do not reach us. We remain as unaffected by events around us as a stone resting in water. Whenever we reach this state, we should strive to remain aware and alert and conscious of the experience. And not, by the way, and not getting into commenting on it, having thoughts about it, or analyzing it, or congratulating ourselves for it. This is the typical reaction when something unusual like this, a makyo, happens. we immediately get drawn into some kind of inner dialogue about it, usually in the form of self-congratulation. And then that is a sure way of having thoughts crowd back into the mind and losing it. Third, we may hear a great clap of thunder which nobody else hears, yet we could swear it shook the entire house. Or the sound we alone hear may be like the buzzing of a bee or the note of a distant trumpet. These auditory experiences would be very unusual to the average person, but to the person who practices Zen, they're quite ordinary. Well, this is three of about 30,000 that I've heard in Doksan, and they really are a test, as most of you know. They're a test because they can be so enticing when they happen to you. You've been sitting and going through dreary hours of boring sitting and wishing something would happen, and then something does happen, something out of the ordinary like this. It's a test because it's so easy then to forget about the breath or the koan and just get all involved mentally in this exciting new experience. But it's a sure way of halting whatever progress you've been making, at least temporarily. So the challenge when these things happen is to just notice it immediately. Notice, identify it as a makyo. Just tell yourself it's just a side effect of sitting. Nothing I want to get involved with. It will pass. I don't want to linger in it. If I linger in it, then I'll get snagged by it. My progress will be impeded. Just leave it alone. Get back to the practice. Post haste. Now, here's an example of my saying this. How many people, when this happens to them, how many people will get right back to the practice? Most of us, maybe all of us, have to make the mistake of getting involved in these makyo 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 times before we finally realize that the teacher knew what he was talking about and that we should just take his advice and leave it alone. Direct experience. It's nothing like it. Finding out for oneself through trial and error the way to go, the way to avoid. Shuyun continues, beyond meditation practice, there is attitude. A beginner must learn to cultivate what is called the poise of a dying man. What is this poise? It is the poise of knowing what is important and what is not, and of being accepting and forgiving. Anyone who has ever been at the bedside of a dying person will understand this poise. What would the dying person do if someone were to insult him? Nothing. What would the dying man do if someone were to strike him? Nothing. As he lay there, would he scheme to become famous or wealthy? No. If someone who had once offended him were to ask him for his forgiveness, would he not give it? Of course he would. A dying person knows the pointlessness of ill will. Hatred is always such a wretched feeling. Who wishes to die feeling hatred in his heart? No one. The dying seek love and peace. There was a time when that dying person indulged himself with feelings of pride, greed, lust, and anger, but now such feelings are gone. There was a time when he indulged his bad habits, but now he is free of them. He carries nothing. He has laid his burdens down. He is at peace. Dear friends, when we have breathed our last, this physical body of ours will become a corpse. If we strive now to regard this physical body as a corpse, that peace will come to us sooner. This reminds me of the circumstances around the enlightenment of Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi was a profoundly, profoundly enlightened Indian sage who came to his awakening spontaneously as a young man. He was only 16. And he was seized with the question of death. But really gripped by it to an almost unimaginable degree. And what he did, just on his own intuition, his own impulse, was he stretched himself out on a table and actually simulated rigor mortis. He just made himself stiff, as he had undoubtedly seen a corpse in the past. He made himself stiff, and he did this sort of imaginary thing where he said, okay, I'm dead. Now, what has died, really? Something like that. And then suddenly, he came to this great enlightenment. He faced it. He faced it directly. And somehow, it's a very rare, rare case, but somehow that facing it in the way that he did enabled him to overcome it, to see through death. Xu Yun continues, if we regarded each day of our life as if it were our last day, we wouldn't waste one precious minute in frivolous pursuits or in grudging, injurious anger. We wouldn't neglect to show love and gratitude to those who had been kind to us. We wouldn't withhold our forgiveness for any offense, small or great. And if we had erred, wouldn't we ask for forgiveness even with our dying breath? We wouldn't waste one precious minute in frivolous pursuits. Well, he's presenting a practically impossible situation. Who would waste one precious minute in frivolous pursuits. So we do. But his point is, how much of our time do we want to waste in frivolous pursuits? How much of our time do we want to spend chewing on anger towards someone? can we see the ultimate futility of trafficking in thoughts, even so-called high-minded thoughts, sophisticated philosophy and ideas about metaphysics or other things. It's ideas, it's notions. Coleridge once said, "Our quaint metaphysical opinions in an hour of anguish are like playthings by the bedside of a child that is deathly sick." In Zazen, especially in the deeper Zazen of Sesshin, we also come to see how ultimately frivolous all our thoughts are. Just thought. Thought by its nature. Thought is on the surface. And yet people can spend much of their waking hours just lost in thoughts. Shuyin continues, "Well then, if this is the great difficulty for a beginner, what obstacle does an intermediate practitioner face?" And then he answers, "Results. After he cultivates the discipline of the Buddha Dharma, he must continue to tend his garden as he awaits the ripening of the mind. However, his waiting must be passive waiting. He cannot expect or schedule the harvest season. In farming, it is possible to estimate how long beans will take to mature or apples to ripen, but enlightenment will come when it will come." I think this could be a little misleading where he says that this waiting for the ripening of the mind must be a passive waiting. Not to think for a minute that we can just sit back waiting for something to happen to us. We have to do our part to ripen this fruit. The French philosopher Simone Weil could have been speaking about Zen practice when she said, "Even if our efforts of attention seem for years to be producing no results, one day a light that is in exact proportion to them will flood the soul." Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.